This is Andrew Geller, and welcome all to the final fellow conference in our series of seminars leading up to the EPA ORD regional workshop on cumulative risk assessments. This has been a series of 10 talks given by folks inside and outside of EPA on the science and practice and direction of cumulative risk assessment. Today's topic approaches to pesticide cumulative risk assessment policy, practice, and implementation, I think is incredibly appropriate to be here in this cleanup slot. The Office of Pesticide Programs, in my opinion, more than any other office in the EPA, has developed a formal structure and practice for doing cumulative risk assessment. Anna Lowitz, who will be presenting the first part of our session today, graduated with a BS in Biological Sciences from Clemson University and a PhD in Environmental Toxicology from University of Tennessee, where she was a graduate fellow in Sustainable Waste Management. She began her career at EPA in 1998 with the Office of Pesticide Programs, where she remains today. Dr. Lowitz is currently a senior scientist in the Health Effects Division, where she advises managers and leads multidisciplinary teams on a variety of cross-cutting topics, including developing cumulative risk assessments for groups of pesticides which share a common mechanism of toxicity. Anna has been at the forefront, one of the main players for OPP in the development of cumulative risk assessments for organophosphate insecticides, the N-methylcarbamates, and is working on the next class of pesticides to undergo a cumulative risk assessment. She also has experience using nonlinear approaches assessing cancer risk instead of pesticides. Finally, she co-chairs EPA's technical panel, developing guidance on the use of pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic data, and developing data-derived extrapolation factors for risk assessment. The second part of our talk will be given by Dr. Virginia or Ginger Moser. Dr. Moser is a research toxicologist in the Toxicology Assessment Division of NHERL in ORD, the National Health and Environmental Effects Lab. Ginger has been at the EPA since receiving a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology. She's focused on the use of neurobehavioral test methods for both toxicity screening and mechanistic research of a wide variety of environmental chemicals, including pesticides, persistent organic pollutants, and drinking water contaminants. I'll say from a personal note, Dr. Moser's research on mixtures, on statistical and experimental models of additivity have really been at the very forefront of the research that driven EPA's ability to do cumulative risk assessments. Dr. Moser is a diplomat of the American Board of Toxicology and received many honors from the EPA, including the Scientific Achievement Award for Human Health Research. She's held several adjunct faculty positions and has over 105 peer-reviewed manuscripts and book chapters published during her. So, to get started, Dr. Lowitz, you lead us off on approaches to pesticide assessment, policy practice, and experimentation.
Sure. Thank you, Andrew. And I'm glad to hear that Ginger joined. I was starting to worry about her a little bit. It is sort of strange as we sit in Potomac Yard. I'm sitting alone in an office with the door closed with my headset on, and all my fellow OPPers are sitting together in a room on another floor. So we wanted to make sure that the sound quality was good, and some of our rooms, our big conference rooms, don't have good sound quality. So I'm sitting all by myself watching the men build a hotel next door. As I start the beginning of my talk, there are a few unique things about the pesticide program that deserve a minute of broader context to give you to set the context for some of those on the phone who may not be familiar with our program. The pesticide program is one of the unique programs at headquarters in that we are self-contained risk management organization. So within the Office of Pesticide Programs, we have about a dozen divisions that includes a number of science technical divisions and risk management divisions. So We work very closely on a daily basis with our internal clients, our risk managers, and our other peers who do both human health and ecological risk assessment, and who do fate and effects. So what you'll see is a very multidisciplinary approach. Our cumulative team that works on these assessments is somewhere in the order of about 50 people strong that crosses about 4 divisions within our program, plus a strong component from the Office of Research and Development. I think you'll see from Ginger's presentation that the collaboration between NHRL and OPP has been extensive. And I'll also add in some things that other folks besides Ginger have done with in collaboration with us to support our assessments. With that, because of the strength of FIFRA and the Food Quality Protection Act, we are, compared to most of the programs, very data-rich. We get a lot of data that's required for pesticide registration. So compared to a lot of other organizations, we are very data-rich, and you'll see that in some of the analyses that we can do, particularly with respect to the hazard assessment side and how we calculate relative potency. We also make a point in all of our work, both cumulative and individual chemical work, to work closely with our other federal partners. So you'll see a lot of information from USDA. We work very closely with them on a regular basis. So with that, I'll just go ahead and go down the slides. Slide number 2 is just the outline of the things that I'm going to try to cover in a very short amount of time. Normally when we do, the entire team does cumulative training on how we do cumulative risk assessment. We give 1- and 2-day entire full-day courses. There's not much that I can cover in detail in a short amount of time in 30 to 45 minutes. But what I promised Chuck and Andrew I would try to do was to cover a little bit of everything to give you a sense of the breadth and the depth and the scope of our assessments. So I'm going to start to talk about the regulatory context and the guidance documents that we have for doing our own assessments. I'm going to have a short introduction on hazard assessment and how we do relative potency, and then a small amount of exposure assessment of food, water, and residential. And I'm going to show you how we're putting the routes together in a cumulative assessment. And what we call track back is a neat concept that I think a lot of people can adopt. And then I'll pull it together at the very end. So as I move to slide number 3, and some of you may find that what's happening on my computer is slide 5 seems to want to trump slide 3 and slide 4. So I'll just talk you through slide 3 and slide 4 because it's mostly text anyway. So if on my computer as I look at it, I went from slide 2 to slide 5 in a heartbeat. But I'll just talk you through slide 3 and 4 if that's happening to you. The EPA's pesticide program is actually a licensee program that regulates pesticide products within the U.S. So what that means is that any pesticide used in this country has to be registered through our program, and that includes both residential products you would buy at the grocery store or at a hardware store, but it also includes anything used on agriculture. We review the effects of both human and ecological, and that's everything from children to adults to workers in the field to all species, and that also includes endangered species. All those things are not included in our cumulative assessments. That's just the breadth of the things that our program does. In 1996, Congress passed the Food Quality Protection Act, which actually amended FIFRA and what we call FFDCA, which did a lot of things, turned our program really upside down. It changed a lot of the requirements of what we have in our assessments. One of the major changes in 1996 was the requirement under FQPA for our program to do what Congress defined as a cumulative risk assessment. And under the statute in our program, a cumulative risk assessment is a multi-chemical, multi-pathway assessment, and only those pesticides that share a common mechanism of toxicity are included in that assessment. So on slide 4, if you could see slide 4, under FQPA, just to be very explicit, cumulative risk is the risk associated with a group of chemicals that share a common mechanism of toxicity. and these assessments are both multi-chemical and multi-pathway. So what we're doing is we're assessing the risk to food, drinking water, and consumer uses simultaneously, all combined for all the chemicals in that class. So we're looking at oral, dermal, and inhalation exposure. So as I move to slide 5, which is an introduction to our cumulative risk assessment guidance, after the passage of FQPA, predominantly Vicky DeLarco, who is our senior scientist for the entire program, had the lead on writing two big guidance documents that I'll introduce over the next couple of slides. And the first one is OPP's cumulative risk assessment guidance, which was established to develop the core principles for developing these assessments and for doing the calculations that we do. Our cumulative guidance is not a recipe book. It is simply a tool and a framework for doing these assessments.
Okay.
We believe that every pesticide class is going to have a different set of issues, and that it should not be a recipe book. And you'll find at the bottom of slide 5 the URL address. If you have interest in looking at guidance, you can find it right there. So as I move to slide 6, the key principles introduced in that guidance are listed here, and we believe these are critical to our assessments, and we adhere to them pretty strongly, actually. So in the first one, what we try to do is we integrate the tox and exposure data. We keep time frame very close in our considerations. As you think about doing an assessment of 20 to 30 compounds in combination, for things that we know that people are exposed to on a regular basis, it's important to think about time frame. When are people exposed? How often are they exposed? What's the duration of that exposure? And then to overlay that with the hazardous assessment component. What is the peak time of effect? What is the duration of the effect? And to overlay those so that we do an appropriate matching of hazard and exposure. We strive for realistic and accurate assessments. We, as you'll see briefly in the slides that I showed towards the end, we rely heavily on monitoring data for our exposure residue information. And we also rely heavily on surveys conducted by individuals who do particular applications. So we try to be absolutely representative of what people are actually doing in the real world. We also avoid trying to compound conservative assumptions. So as in our typical assessments of individual chemicals, we make a lot of conservative assumptions, particularly with respect to exposure. But when we put these chemicals together in a large kilo assessment, we intentionally strip out a lot of these conservative assumptions. The idea being that if we do an assessment of 20 or 30 compounds in combination, and we have a lot of compounding conservative assumptions, we'll end up with risk estimates at the end that are sort of meaningless and that cannot be interpreted. So by pulling out a lot of these compounding conservative assumptions, we try to make our assessments accurate and something that are realistic. And we find that by doing that, our in-house risk managers take them very seriously. Another thing that we do in our assessments that really gives them a lot of depth and breadth is that we preserve and maintain both geographical, temporal, and demographic specificity. And what I mean by that is that we believe individuals who live in Florida have very distinct pesticide exposures than those that live in South Dakota. Similarly, people who live in Southern California have distinctly different pesticide exposures than those that live in Maine. And that's on a individual basis, it's on a seasonal basis, it's on an age-specific basis, and that we need to maintain that specificity for every individual across the entire country. And part of the way that we do that is a calendar-based approach, and I'll show you briefly towards the end. As the magnitude and the scope of these assessments get bigger and bigger and more complicated, it's critical for us to be able to track back, what we call track back, to the original exposure. So what is the source of a particular residue by chemical, by a commodity, by a chemical, by a residential product? We need to be able to get back to that exposure so that in the event that there are risk, our risk managers can identify it and can do something about it. As I move to slide 7, the cumulative risk assessment guidance establishes a series of just basic steps that are relatively intuitive, but we find by following them and discussing them publicly, it helps organize your thinking. In accordance with what the statute says, the first thing that we do when we do a cumulative assessment is to identify a common mechanism group, or what we call a CMG. Once we identify a common mechanism group, we look in a very explicit manner of what the relevant exposure scenarios and pathways are. So we look at the different classes of chemicals and to see if food is the predominant pathway or water, whether it's groundwater or surface water. We look at residential products to see if these are in-home uses or versus pet uses or possibly golf course and that sort of thing. Based on step number two, based on the scenarios and the pathways, we identify a subset of our common mechanism grouping of what we call our cumulative assessment group, which is a subset of those pesticides in that group that we're actually going to include in our assessment. So, for example, there may be a class that's very large that over a historical period of time, a number of those chemicals have been canceled or seriously restricted. We would not include a canceled chemical, for example, in our assessment. After we establish using a Federal Register notice where a cumulative assessment group is, then we actually begin the work of doing the assessment. We look at methods. We look at data sources. We often go to the Science Advisory Panel to get feedback on the direction that we're taking. And then after we do all that, we'll actually conduct the assessment. We select the common mechanism endpoints, which I'll talk about in a minute. We select the index chemical. We calculate relative potency. We convert pesticide residues to equivalents of that index, and then we actually combine all of the pathways, food, water, and residential, on a manner that's both demographic, spatially, and temporally explicit. So as I move on to slide 8, we can introduce our second guidance document that the pesticide program has. As Congress asked us to focus on those pesticides that have a common mechanism of toxicity, we have a guidance for identifying those. And in that guidance, there are two major definitions. First is what we define as a mechanism of toxicity. And under the FQPA for the cumulative, we define mechanism as the major steps leading to an adverse effect of a pesticide. And we believe all the steps leading to that do not need to be specifically understood. And so that a common mechanism is two or more pesticide chemicals that share this common toxic effect by the same pathway or essentially the same pathway. And just like the other guidance document, what I've done is for you provide the URL to get the PDF of that document that you can find on the bottom of slide 8. So if you move to slide 9, if you're following on the computer, you're going to need to click the button a couple times because I normally use this slide in a large group where I can see everyone and I can talk through the moving of the figures into the slide. So hopefully you're looking at a figure that has some red triangles and blue circles and yellow squares on the right side. So our task is a daunting one, actually, to look at all of the pesticide chemicals registered in the U.S. and to divide them into their groups by their same common mechanism. So if I move on to slide 10, how do we do this, and how do we determine a common mechanism of toxicity under the guidance document? We have three general principles that we follow. First, that the chemicals act on the same molecular target at the same target tissue. And the second point is that they act by the same biochemical mechanism. And in some cases, this may be that they share a common toxic intermediate. And the third one is that they share the same critical toxic effect. And what's important about the first two steps that are different than the third one, there are many chemicals that may share the same critical toxic effect. Let's say there are lots of pesticides that affect the liver. There are lots of pesticides that are neurotoxic. Under the FQPA, under what Congress has asked us to do, we will not put all neurotoxic chemicals or all liver carcinogens in the same group. They have to cause the tumor or the toxicity by the same chemical pathway. And that is the principles of the first two bullets. So as I move to slide 11, some more things that we think about. And this is very much in line, the bullets on slide 11 are very much in line with the Motive Action Framework, for those of you who are familiar with that. We ask our question is if there's concordance in dose response and timing between the major steps for the chemicals in the group. Is the common mechanism biologically and chemically plausible, i.e. does it make sense? And what are the strengths and the uncertainties of the available data? We need to know what the strengths and the uncertainties are as we move forward, so that we can appropriately describe what those uncertainties are as we begin to actually calculate risk. And the fourth one is that we think about what alternative mechanisms of action there could be. We admit in our common mechanism guidance that many pesticides actually have multiple mechanisms of action, and we just have to keep in the back of our mind at all times that some of these multiple mechanisms could actually be driving certain outcomes and be affecting potency. But that's just something to be aware of and something that we're always thinking about. So slide 12, you may want to hit the button twice because there's also some animation on this one. So that's the basic introduction of how we do our assessments. Congress has given us a very specific task. It's not a small task, and it is actually quite daunting once you think about it. But we've developed some guidance, and we think that we're moving on in the right direction. So the next series of slides is actually going to talk about how we do our assessments. I'll begin with hazard, so we'll talk about relative potency, and then I'll move towards exposure. So that's what slide 12 is about. It's about thinking about relative potency. One of the most important tasks in our assessments is to take the chemicals in the group and to rank them. And how we rank them and the quality of the ranking has a lot to do with the quality of the risk estimates that come out at the end. Garbage in is garbage out. High quality in is high quality out. We admit that we would much prefer to use PBPK models or pharmacokinetic models to derive internal metrics of dose to calculate potency, or even to use explicitly in our calculations using exposure. But in the groups, the major groups we've done so far, these kind of pharmacokinetic models have not been available on a large scale to do that kind of analysis. This is changing very much with the pyrethroids that I'll get to at the very, very end. But so the assessments that we have out right now for the groups that we've done, we have not used PBPK models. Instead, what we've done is a relative potency-based approach where we take the chemicals in the class, in the common assessment group, and we select one of them to be what we call the index chemical. And we select this index chemical to be the chemical in the class that has the highest quality database for the common mechanism endpoint. And that doesn't have to be the most potent one. It doesn't have to be the most popular one. It doesn't have to be the one with the biggest database. It has to be the one with the best data set for the common mechanism endpoint. And what we do is we prefer to use benchmark dose techniques so that we compare all the compounds on a common footing. So we're comparing them to apples to apples. When you use NOELs or LOELs, you're going to be comparing different response rates. So by using a benchmark dose, we get a common response level for calculating our relative potency. So when we do that, we get a benchmark dose for our index chemical, and we divide it by the chemical of interest. And setting the ratio up in this way allows the relative potency factors to get bigger for the more toxic chemicals. The more potent, the bigger the number, the less potent, the smaller the number. It's just intuitive that way. That's easier to explain. So what we're going to do is we're going to take exposure equivalents in index units and convert everything in the assessment to units of that index chemical. So I moved on to slide 13, some of the things that we've done with our hazard assessments. There are a lot of ways that you could do this. You could do in different ways that we've done it in our four big assessments. If you have an individual chemical, and you can use a single study. You can use a single endpoint. But we've also tried to do in the two real big classes that we have, when we have multiple studies for multiple studies that measure the same endpoint for the same chemical, is to do a more complicated analysis that pools all the data for that individual chemical together in one analysis. So that's what the slide shows on slide number 13. The plot on the right side is for a chemical called methimidofos, which is an OP. And if you don't know OPs very much, methimidofos is not used in the residential setting, which is most, a lot of you probably never heard of it. It is used in agricultural, particularly on tomatoes. But methimidofos, without a doubt, has hands down the strongest database of all of the OPs. The data set, the plot you see on the right, I've used many times in many presentations, and it blows me away every time I see this graph. On this graph, you have data from three studies. The red is the female rats. The blue is the male. The dotted line are the upper and lower confidence limits. The straight lines are the central estimate on the dose response curve. All the little dots are the dose response data from the three studies. The three studies were done in, one was done in Germany, two in the U.S. They were done 20 years apart. There are data as short as day 28 of exposure all the way out to 720. And that you have, this is all brain cholinesterase data. So you have data from three labs, 20 years apart, two sexes, about seven time points, and there's amazing concordance, particularly if you look at the scale, the dose scale, how tight that data set is. It's just phenomenal. And there's data on, from dermal and also inhalation for methimidofos. Only one study, but it is also just as beautiful. What we believe is using multiple data sets for the same chemical allows us to get a very robust estimate of potency and also helps us get a sense of the uncertainty and the variability, not the uncertainty, the variability, excuse me, around a particular chemical. So if you move on to the next slide, which should be slide 14, this actually shows all the relative potency factors used in the OP cumulative assessment. Malathion being the least potent for brain and for brain cholinesterase, dicrotophos on the right side being the most potent. You may see the third one from the right, the little square gray box, if you're looking at it up close, is actually methimidofos. That's the data set that I showed you on the previous slide. Those data are so tight that the error bars don't show up on the scale that I have this plot on. So the nice thing about doing that multi-study analysis is that we can, for all these chemicals, get a sense of the variability for each individual chemical across their whole database. And you can just scan across with your eyes and see that the magnitude of the error bars really vary substantially across the OPs. Okay, so as we move on to slide 15, and one more thing before I leave the OPs. In both our CARBAM-H and OP cumulative assessment, we have worked extremely closely with Dr. Woody Setzer, who is now at the Comp Talk Center of ORD. He has done all our dose response modeling for both of those assessments, and in my view is one of the most talented people at EPA and has really revolutionized how we do dose response assessment. Okay, so as we moved on to slide 15. I'll show you another example of dose response analysis from the N-methylcarbamate assessment. And this one, instead of focusing on a relative potency, what I'll do is I'll show you how we've thought about time course. Our carbamate hazard assessment is also a close collaborative effort with ORD. Data generated in labs of Stephanie Padilla and Ginger Moser have been extremely important in our carbamate assessment. And the dose response modeling of Woody Setzer is, as I noted a minute ago, extremely important in that assessment. We have, with Woody's help and for the carbamate assessment, calculated both relative potency and also recovery half-lives for the carbamates. If you're not really familiar with the N-methylcarbamates, they're distinctly different from the OPs in that they're very rapidly acting. Everything with a carbamate happens fast. It's the onset is fast, the recovery is fast. The typical peak time to effect for a carbamate is something in the order of 15 to 40 minutes, and the typical recovery in adult animals, the half-life is usually something around 1 to 2 hours. So everything with a carbamate happens very fast. And so as part of that, Woody Setzer in his analysis did a simultaneous calculation of relative of benchmark dose, but also half-life to recovery, which has been important as we think about exposure. And I'll talk about that later. But so what's important here is back to one of those key principles in our cumulative assessments. It's the matching of hazard and exposure. If with carbamates, as everything happens rapidly, the onset and the recovery are rapid, what we believe is the most important thing to do in our exposure assessment is to think about everything just on a one-day scale. And in fact, we're actually getting smaller than that these days with our carbamates, and we're doing our exposure assessments on eating events, because in large part, the exposure that you see at breakfast is distinctly different from the exposure that you see at dinner, because recovery should have completely occurred between those two. So it's all about matching hazard and exposure. So if you move on to slide 16, there's some time course data. This is for oxamil, which happens to be the index chemical for the carbamate assessment. This is some data out of Stephanie Padilla's lab, which shows, I think, very nicely the recovery of the carbamate. You can see from the top boxes as you move left to right down to the bottom that the slope on that line gets flatter and flatter. That's the time course of the peak time to effect at the top towards the left, and then the complete recovery on the bottom right. Slide 17, I'll just introduce the idea of the mixtures, and Ginger is truly the expert here, and I'll let her handle all of that. But as of the relative potency-based approach is the foundation of our cumulative assessments, implicit in a relative potency-based approach is the assumption of dose additivity. We are, when we convert everything to an index chemical and then convert all our residues to units of that, assuming that the chemicals are essentially dilutions of one another and that we are doing dose addition, assuming dose addition. And to support the foundation of those assumptions, we've been working closely with both Stephanie and Ginger to develop mixture studies from either multiple OPs or multiple carbamates. And that's what you see on slide 17 is some of the adult carbamate mixture data for brain cholinesterase, where the black represents the actual data from I believe this is the 7 chemical mixture, and the red is the expected curve based on dose additivity. And you can see that the red and the black match extremely well and support our assumption of dose additivity for the carbamates. Okay, so as I move on to slide 18, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and move from hazard to exposure. And if you remember in my beginning introduction, I said that we were a self-contained program. Unlike some other parts of the agency, we do within the same division, within the same teams, we calculate both hazard assessment and exposure assessment. So we're doing the full-blown risk with hazard and exposure. And we have a lot of very talented people here who do exposure assessment for food, water, and residential assessments. I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but enough that I think I can give you the cursory view. And I'm not going to do too much in this exposure assessment area because Chuck and Andrew and others have asked that our presentation from our program at the Chicago meeting focus on spatial and temporal aspects of our assessments. And so I'm only going to give you a hint at some of the really neat things that we're doing in that arena and leave most of it for my presentation in Chicago. But just to start the exposure assessment piece of the talk, it's worth noting that in virtually all, and I mean all, both our single chemical and our cumulative assessments, we are using probabilistic techniques in virtually every risk assessment that we do now on exposure. Our food assessments have led the way. Our water assessments are now essentially virtually all of them are probabilistic, and more every day we're doing more and more probabilistic exposures assessments with residential. So we're relying heavily on Monte Carlo techniques, and in our cumulative assessments, we have actually done all of the multi-pathway as cumulative, and I'll give you an example of that later on. So as we move to slide 19, the reason that we really focus on the probabilistic techniques with the cumulative assessments is part of, is in line with our principle that we want our assessments to be geographically, spatially, temporally, and demographically explicit. So we want to be able to maintain accurate and reasonable estimates of risk. So using probabilistic techniques allows us to do that. And we do a time-based integration or a calendar-based approach, and I'll certainly move on to that. Okay, so slide 20, it's worth noting again that one of the most important things that we think in our assessments is you do an assessment of 30 or so pesticides for every region of the country, essentially intended to be for every individual in the U.S., we have to be able to track back to what that initial exposure event was. We have to know what the fruit or the vegetable was. We have to know what the chemical was on that fruit. We have to know what the pesticide homeowner product was. If we can't get back to those products and those commodities and those residues, our risk managers cannot take action. Okay, so we move on to 21. So if we look at 21, we have four different software Monte Carlo programs that we're using. Lifeline, CARES, and if you know CARES, it's originally developed by a group of pesticide manufacturers. Deem CalIndex, and SHEDS, which is SHEDS is ORD product from Neural. All four of these models conform to both agency and OPP specific guidance on models, which means that their code is publicly available. They've been through extensive peer review. Each of these four models has its own pros and cons, and if you want to talk specifically about what those are and what the neat things about different models are, I can refer you to some other folks than myself. Okay, so moving on to slide 22. What sort of inputs do we use in all these models? Because they all use the same basic inputs. They need some toxicity information, whether it's a benchmark dose or relative potency or a NOEL or just a good old-fashioned RFD. They also need information on exposure, and this can be very simple, and sometimes it can get extremely complicated. We need information on residues, whether it's residues in food or water or on a surface, let's say a table surface or in carpet or in air. We also need information on behavior, whether it's food consumption, how many apples do people eat in the setting, what's the variability of that, what's the distribution of that apple consumption. And does that vary by age? The same thing with water. What we're interested in is looking at distributions of water consumption. Then we think about how humans behave with residential products, how they apply those products, where they apply those products, how much do they use. Then we think about doing our children's assessment to children, let's say toddlers playing either in grass or playing on carpet, how those children crawling around on their knees or maybe putting their hands in their mouth, how those behaviors affect exposure, and particularly interested in looking at distributions of those behaviors so that we can do our probabilistic exposure assessment. The output of the models also is relatively straightforward. They have the same basic output. They tend to output exposure levels on a milligram per kilogram body weight day basis. One of the unique things about SHEDS is that SHEDS is going to begin to output data on an individual basis, on an individual person basis, whereas all the other models right now are putting them on more aggregate, large-scale, combined outputs. They all look at different risk metrics. You can tell the computer, the models, what risk metric you want, whether it's an RFD-type metric, a percent. You think about, we always talk about risk cups around here, that the risk cup is full or it's not full or it's half full or 90% full, so percent of the RFD occupied. Or we often use margin of exposure when we do multi-pathway, and lots of different programs use different metrics. But you can have those programs do whatever metric you want, basically. And the output also describes what we call as risk drivers, so the chemicals, the commodities, the uses which contribute to the risk. So as I move to slide 23, We prefer to use data from well-known surveys because, in part, those surveys are usually conducted by individuals who use those products or people who agree to participate in surveys and give how much they eat and when and how often and those things. They tend to be pretty good sources of data. It also allows us to look at the seasonal and age-specific behaviors in that way. So then move on to slide 24. What sort of age groups are we looking at? Our mandate is to cover every person in the country. So we look at everyone from those who are just born all the way up to more aged individuals. And we do have them segmented a little bit different than that recommended by and used by some of the other offices in the agency. We look at infants less than one as a group. But that is in large part because we believe some of the survey information on particularly around food and water exposure to young children, the sample size of kids less than one is relatively small, and segmenting them by ages of months really shrinks that sample size down. We look at kids age 1 to 2, 3 to 5, and it's my experience that the kids ages 1 to 2 and 3 to 5 tend to drive a lot of our risk estimates and drive a lot of the mitigation efforts that we undergo here. This tends to be because children in the 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 category have some different things. They tend to eat more on a per body weight basis than do older children or adults. They tend to have what we call hand-to-mouth behavior still at these ages, i.e. they're crawling around on the floor and sticking their hands in their mouth. I can attest that my 2-year-old, her two fingers are always in her mouth. And also for a lot of compounds, there's a dynamic component that younger children are more sensitive based on pharmacodynamics or pharmacokinetics than are older children or adults. So there's several good reasons why kids 1 to 2 and 3 to 5 tend to drive our risk assessments. So as I look at slide 25, we're doing predominantly a regional approach in our assessments of both water and residential use. Many people know that water is a very local exposure. You can have different water exposure from people in different streets, particularly in places where you have people certain contaminated sites, and I'm sure the regional folks can explain that to me much better. But for residential products, because there's such a large difference across the country of weather and of climate, we do regional assessments. And our 7 regions that we've been using are not derived from the EPA regions, if you look at the map at all. What we did several years ago was to start with the USDA regions for agriculture. They have 12 or 13 regions identified for agriculture around the country. And we combined a number of those to the six or seven that we're doing in our cumulative assessments, based on by overlaying their regional assessments for agriculture overlaid with our use and usage data around what pesticides are used in which part of the country.
I'm just going to do a little time check to let you know we're on slide 25 of 83, and you have approximately 45 minutes left for the session.
Okay. What time is it?
It's 12:44, so I just wanted to have you move it along.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll just I can skip a few. Why don't I just skip to 28? Because I think that's one of the neat things. I'm glad you told me. Because I should have watched the time myself. Just skip to slide 28. In our food risk assessment, our food assessments are probably among the most highly refined there are anywhere. And one of the really neat things that we're doing with the help of some of our statisticians here is we're able to actually take outputs from the models and separate them by chemical and commodity. So what you see on slide 28 is actually a plot out of the methylcarbamate cumulative assessment that shows the chemical crop combinations that are driving the risk at the upper tails of the distribution. And you can see allocarb on potatoes is a major driver. And so you can see those commodities that have multiple carbamates that are used on them. And this is what we mean by track back. This kind of plot helps our risk managers identify which chemicals or commodities they need to look closer at for risk mitigation purposes. I'm just, for purposes of brevity, because there's some other stuff I want to cover, the drinking water will be a large chunk of my presentation in Chicago because some of the neatest things that we're doing are around there. So if you skip to slide 31 and our residential exposure assessments, for residential, we're also doing regional assessments, and we rely heavily on survey data, and we've covered much of this already. Okay, let's jump to slide 33. Because this really puts it all together for those of you who haven't ever seen these slides. And hopefully you can look closely at the screen and you're not in a room with a big screen, because you have to stare at this plot. This is actually the output from Calindex, the output of the probabilistic assessment on the calendar. These are Julian days, so day one is January 1st, day 365 is December 31st. So as you move from left to right, you go from winter to spring to fall and back to winter. Each color is a route, and the multi-pathway, I believe, is the green. So what you see is that the bright yellow that sits on top of the green is inhalation, and this was pulled, this plot comes from the OP cumulative assessment. So that yellow is really the indoor exposure to dichlorvos, or what some of you may know as DDVP. You can see the water event, the bottom one, the bright pink on the bottom. There would have been a runoff event sometime later in the year where you see that spike. And so you can see the temporal nature of different exposures. I can spend an hour on this graph explaining it to you, but that's okay. Slide 34. In our cumulative assessments, we have been very transparent, we believe, in our assessments. We have done numerous public technical briefings that last days. At one time we did a technical briefing that lasted an entire week. We've been to the FIFRA Science Advisory Panel, or what we call the SAP. We stopped counting when we got to 25. I think by now we're well in the 30 to 35 range of how many times we've gotten advice from the SAP on our methods and approaches and the directions that we're taking. We tend to follow a basic structure. We conduct a preliminary assessment where we get public comment, and we go to the SAP. About a year after that, we will typically do a revised assessment where we also get public comment. And then most of the time, in a year after that, or possibly two, we do another revised assessment. We have an entire website dedicated to pesticide cumulative assessment, which you see there. We have so far done four of these big assessments. The two big boys are the OPs and the N-methyl carbamates I talked about a little bit, but we've also done assessments on the triazines and the chlorazepanilines. And if you don't know that class, it's Alachlor and Metolachlor, probably the two most famous ones. On slide 36, we are at the beginning phases of working with the pyrethroids on the pyrethroid cumulative assessment. There is a very large-scale research program, a collaborative effort between OPP, NHURL, the neural lab, and NCCT to produce the next generation of our cumulative assessments. ORD is developing PVK models for a handful of pyrethroids, and we're going to almost physically be linking those models to the SHED's probabilistic model. So our goal a couple years from now will be to actually calculate distributions of pyrethroid concentration in brain for different populations across the entire country. So that's really exciting work that we're doing. And I think on slide 37, I just come back to my key principles that I think are the basics of how we do a cumulative assessment. We think time frame is critical. You have to do an appropriate matching of tox and exposure. We strive to have realistic and accurate assessments. By removing many of the compounding conservatisms, we create assessments that we believe are very realistic and that people take very seriously. We think it's critical to maintain geographic, temporal, and demographic specificity across the entire country, and that for purposes of making these assessments usable to a risk manager and usable to the public, we believe that being able to track back to initial exposure is absolutely critical. And with that, I just think I hit an hour, and I'll stop.
Thank you very, very much, Anna. That was lovely, and as you say, very, very fast trip through a very, very complex set of features that Office of Pesticide Programs has developed over the last decade. How about if we take a couple minutes for questions, perhaps just a clarification at this point, before Ginger starts. So for folks on the phone, I open it up for just a couple of questions.
Anna, hi, this is Winona Victory in Region 9. I'm very impressed with the work that your program is doing, and I'm wondering, with the proposed faster, cheaper toxicology testing that's going on at the agency, are pesticides going to be part of that effort, or is it, how are the testing methods changing?
I'll let Andrew answer that because he probably doesn't know better than anyway. But I think it's safe to say that our program is in many ways leading that effort because of the size of the pesticide databases for guideline studies. They're actually collecting the pesticide databases are actually being used to ground truth a lot of the work that they're doing at through ToxCast. The what's called the ToxRef database is actually being populated by in large part by OPP's database of pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in many ways, I think, driving a lot of the tox testing of the 21st century. Vicky DeLarco deserves a lot of credit for that.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't think I need to add to that. Any more questions?
I have one. Since all these routes of intake are correlated with respect to energy expenditure, I'm just wondering how you handle the correlation between water intake and air intake and caloric intake, et cetera.
I guess I'm not really sure what the what your question is. But what the models are doing simultaneously is to calculate all those routes simultaneously. So if you have an individual in a room that, let's say, has been sprayed with a fogger, that person would be breathing air and touching surfaces, and so the dermal absorption and the air exposure will be handled simultaneously.
I think, Anna, this is Andrew, that was Tom McCurdy, and I believe Tom was asking about some of the details that go into the exposure models where the estimates of ingestion and water consumed are essentially derived from activity values and then derived from bioenergetics. So whether there's any confounding or interaction between those values from the bioenergetics. Does that capture it, Tom?
Yeah, you did a very good job, Andrew.
So, Anna, I don't know if that would be a question for David Miller's group, much more so at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to ask him if we can. I mean, I'll have David get back to you if you'd like.
In time, and I'd like to move on. Gene, I imagine that there are also some questions that have come in through the instant messaging service.
Yes, we have about three questions that came in online.
All right, so let's keep those in mind as we move toward through the next part of this presentation. Dr. Ginger Moser of the Office of Research and Development, the National Health and Environmental Effects, will now take us through some of the experimentation that's provided the science backdrop for the work that the Office of Pesticides program has been doing. Ginger?
Thank you, Andrew, and thanks to everyone who's hanging in there for part two. I'll be continuing this seminar on slide 39 by discussing the experimental aspects of conducting studies that are useful for informing the cumulative risk assessments that you've heard about. Given the background and the policy issues that Anna discussed, I want to talk about ways to translate what's needed for mixture risk assessment into questions and experimental designs that can be taken into the laboratory. So if you go to the next slide, slide 40, I just want to first acknowledge the many people who have contributed to the data that I'll be showing you today. Over the years, we've worked a lot with the biostatisticians of Virginia Commonwealth University, And they're the ones that developed the mathematical and statistical models that I'll be hoping to explain to you today. On slide 41, I don't really need to point out to this audience that there are many reasons for doing mixtures research. The type of research I'll talk about today is component-based, that is, the chemicals that make up the mixtures are known, at least for the most part. Information that's important includes an understanding of the exposures, the chemical-specific information, and the use of the appropriate statistical analyses. Okay, slide 42, I'm taking a step back to address terminology. Additivity is defined as a zero interaction. That is, the effects of the mixture are adequately predicted by the component. Synergy indicates that the response is greater than that predicted by additivity, and antagonism is when the response is less than predicted. My talk is going to focus on dose additivity as opposed to response additivity. In dose additivity, the chemicals interact as if they were dilutions of one another. It's important to note that these chemicals don't necessarily have to have the same shape of the dose response or the same slope. They don't even have to have the same mechanism of action. Also, with dose addition, you can combine chemicals at sub-threshold doses, and you may get a response that still reflects additivity. Okay, slide 43. A classic way of looking at dose additivity is to plot isobolograms. These graphs show the simple case of a binary mixture. On the graph on the left, you plot a specific effect dose, like a dose producing a 50% effect or an ED50, for both chemicals individually. The isobole is the line of equal effective combinations. If you take a dose of 4, say, of chemical A, collect dose response data for chemical B in the presence of 4 milligrams of chemical A, then the resulting ED50 should fall on this line if it's dose additive. You can connect any magnitude of effect, like the dose graph on the right, where it shows ED10s or ED20s or ED50s. The problem with this approach is that you have to run a lot of dose response curves, which is a considerable undertaking when you're doing animal research. So another approach is to use array design, as shown on slide 44. Instead of having a line of equal effective doses for all combinations of the two chemicals, you plot a dose response with a fixed combination of the chemicals, and then it will cut through the isoboles. For example, a single dose response of a mixture with two parts A and one part B will give ED10s, 20s, and 50s that are shown along this bottom line on the graph. Information that's derived is limited to the mixing ratio that's being tested, and that's why the mixing ratio is so important. So to summarize, an isobole is a curve that's fit to points with a fixed response, whereas an array is a curve fit to points with fixed ratios. Okay, if you go to the next slide, there are many advantages of using ray designs in mixtures research. There's theoretically no limit to the number of chemicals that can be included, so you can go way beyond binary combinations. Compared to the isobolographic approach, it's economical and efficient. There are now published methods to statistically test for additivity using these methods. The mixture that you want to study can be devised based on a specific experimental question, and it can also be used to generate hypotheses for further testing. Slide 46 shows the general methodology for using ray designs in the studies I'll be showing you. First, dose response data are collected for each chemical in the mixture, and dose response models are fit to those data. A predicted model of additivity is generated based on those individual data, and also based on the mixing ratio that's being tested. A dose response is collected for that mixture. The model fit to those data is statistically compared to the predicted model. There are several ways you can do this. For example, testing whether the statistically derived thresholds are equal, for testing whether the parameters of the models are equal, or for seeing if the experimental data fall within some confidence limits that are defined by the predicted model. Okay, the next slide, slide 47. Now, as I've mentioned, to do these ray designs, you do need good characterization of the dose responses for the individual chemicals as well as the mixture. Consideration in experimental design includes the selection of the chemicals, what combinations to look at, and what mixing ratios to use, and that's what I'm going to try to describe. But we can't ignore the other issues such as dose rate, the sequence of administration, the route of administration, and there are a lot of other factors. So on slide 48, I'm going to provide some background for our studies that we conducted with organophosphate pesticides, the OPs. Why did we want to look at the OPs? Well, they were and widely used pesticides. They're still widely used. There's a high potential for human exposures to mixtures of OPs since they're used on various crops, pets, and around the home. They have a common mode of action, as you've heard. That is, they all inhibit the acetylcholinesterase enzyme, and this action causes prolonged firing of cholinergic nerves, and their toxicity is related to this action. It's also interesting that some of the epidemiological studies are implicating OPs in neurological adverse effects, even at very low concentrations that may not be predicted by the individual chemicals. Why did we choose five? Monitoring data such as the pesticide data program, which Anna kind of skipped over in one of her slides, shows that where there is co-occurrence of these chemicals on food products, there were almost always five or less chemicals. We were focusing these studies on food use scenarios, so that's why we chose five. The next slide. The choice of OPs was mostly based on the potential for human exposures through both usage and food residue patterns. We ended up with chlorpyrifos, diazinon, malathione, acephate, and dimethylate. At the time that we ran these studies, these chemicals were among the top 10 in terms of usage in the U.S. To decide what ratio to use, we looked at the dietary exposure values that were predicted by the dietary exposure estimate model, or DEEM model, that Anna talked about. Now, slide 50 just shows an example of the DEEM output for one of our chemicals, for chlorpyrifos. We decided to use the value at the 95th percentile of exposure for the general U.S. population. Doing this, we came up with the ratios that are listed on this slide. You can see that malathione made up the bulk of this mixture. Go to slide 51. Another way to look at pesticide usage is with these maps that are provided by the USGS. This slide shows the maps for the five OPs that we study. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of geographical overlap, especially in California and the Southeast. And these maps are available for all the pesticides that are in use. If you go to the next slide, what did we expect when we first ran this study? Dose additivity is EPA's default assumption. But there are some old reports showing non-additivity in binary mixtures of some of the OP pesticides. Most of these showed synergy, but they were looking at high concentrations and mostly dealing with lethality. There's also a well-known pharmacokinetic interaction with malathione and other OPs. And in fact, there are several metabolic sites where interactions that are non-additive could occur. Also, there were some recent papers that showed non-additivity that were based on the sequence of administration of a couple of OPs. So slide 53 shows our experimental design. We used multiple endpoints in order to better characterize the interactions. We measured brain and blood cholinesterase inhibition, since this represents the common mode of action for these pesticides. We also collected behavioral data, including locomotor activity, an evaluation of gait, and the response to a tail pinch. These are endpoints that we have found in previous studies to be very sensitive to these cholinesterase inhibitors. I'm only showing you today the data for brain cholinesterase and motor activity, but these data have been published, and I've got the reference at the bottom of some of the slides. The motor activity is measured in this chamber that you see on the right side that's shaped like a figure eight, and the rat runs around and breaks the photo beams, and that's what we measure as locomotor activity. We looked at a mixture of all five pesticides, which we called the full ray, and then we had another mixture that didn't include malathione. The remaining chemicals were giving it the same concentrations as the full ray, and that's what we called the reduced ray. We used male rats, dosed orally. They were behaviorally tested 4 hours after dosing. This was the time of peak effect for these chemicals. Immediately after testing, they were sacrificed for tissue collection. We tested adults and also pre-weanling rats, 17 days of age, so we could evaluate whether there are any age-related differences in the interactions. Now, the next slide shows the brain cholinesterase data for each of these chemicals. Malathion itself is not very toxic and didn't inhibit cholinesterase at the doses that we used. The y-axis on all these graphs shows the percent of controlled cholinesterase activity, so a decreasing curve shows greater inhibition. You can immediately see that the slopes of these curves were somewhat different. Now, slide 55 shows the mixture data for brain cholinesterase. The left graph is the full ray, all five pesticides, and the right graph is the reduced ray that had malathion removed. In all these graphs, the red line is what was predicted under additivity based on the individual chemicals. The points are the actual data, and the dashed line shows the model that were fit to the experimental data. Full and the reduced rays significantly deviated from the predicted additivity line, and the response was greater than predicted, so it was synergism. Also, when comparing the full and reduced rays directly, there was no difference, showing that malathion didn't contribute to this synergism. Now, if you go to the next slide, it shows the individual data for locomotor activity for these pesticides, and again, malathion had no effect. Here, the y-axis shows the activity counts over the session, and as the rats are more affected, activity levels decrease. Slide 57 shows the graphs that show the mixture data. Again, the experimental data were shifted to the left of the predicted line, showing synergy, which was the same type of response we saw with the brain cholinesterase. The table on slide 58 summarizes the data for all the endpoints. For four of the five endpoints analyzed, we saw synergy with the full ray. This was also the case for three of the endpoints with the reduced ray. In some cases, the two rays were different, and in other cases, they were not. But if you compare doses such as ED20s and ED50s, the shift in these values ranged from about a 1.2-fold to a 2.1-fold shift, which is really not a large shift. Now, the next slide shows, for the 17-day-old rats, the brain cholinesterase inhibition. The young rats are more sensitive to some of these OPs, which is why we could measure cholinesterase inhibition with malathion in this case. If you go to slide 60, I'm flying through these slides, I know. As we saw with the adults, the experimental data were shifted to the left of the predicted line for brain cholinesterase, indicating synergism. In this case, the full and the reduced rays were significantly different from each other. The next slide summarizes the data in the young rats. We saw synergy on all the endpoints with the full ray, and in most cases with the reduced ray. The magnitude of this shift in dose response was somewhat greater than in adults, and the differences were about 1.3-fold to a 3.5-fold. Still, that's about only a half a log order of magnitude. Slide 62 summarizes our data with the OP mixtures. We saw greater than additive responses with both mixtures and with both ages. The interaction depended on the endpoint, and the influence of malathion also depended on the endpoint. So it's not really a simple story. Now I want to get into, the next slide, 63, I want to talk about our studies with the N-methylcarbamate pesticides. Like the OPs, the carbamate pesticides also have broad agricultural and residential uses, and they were the next set of pesticides that went through the cumulative risk assessment by OPP. They have a common mode of action, the inhibition of acetylcholinesterase, but they're different from OPs in that the onset and duration of action is much faster. We tested a mixture of seven carbamates. These carbamates had high usages and therefore high contribution to the risk assessment that was going on at the time, and these studies were conducted in collaboration with the team at OPP. So if you go to slide 64, the pesticides that we settled on were carbaryl, carbofuran, fermentinate, methiocarb, methamyl, oxamyl, and propoxyr. For the mixing ratios, we took two approaches. One was to use the ratio that was used in the risk assessment, the relative potency factor approach. You've already heard about this from Anna and how it was derived. We also wanted to look at a proportion based on actual usage, and we found data on the tons of each carbamate sold in California in 2005. We figured the amount sold would be a surrogate for total exposures, and we call this our California environmental mixture. Slide 65 shows the relative potencies of the 10 carbamates that were included in the risk assessment. You can see they span over two orders of magnitude in terms of potency. Carbaryl and propoxyl were the least potent of our seven pesticides, and fermentinate and carbofuran were the most potent. Slide 66 shows where we got our California data. This is a snapshot of the website of the Cal EPA, Department of Pesticide Regulation. It's really a great site where you can get information on amount of pesticides sold in California, how much was used on specific crops by year, and all kinds of good stuff. The next slide gives the mixing ratios that were used in these two studies. The relative potency factor mixture was actually quite different from the California mixture. For example, carbaryl was the main pesticide in one, whereas methomyl was the main pesticide in the other. Also, there was a lot of propoxyl in the relative potency factor mixture, but very little in the California mixture. Okay, we're at slide 68. The experimental approach was very similar to that I've already described for the OPs. And again, I'll only show the brain cholinesterase and the locomotor activity data. We used acute oral dosing, but this time we tested at 40 minutes. We've conducted these studies in adults and 17-day-old rats, but we don't have the statistical analyses from the young rats yet. The next slide shows the brain cholinesterase graphs for four of the seven carbamates. Again, you can see that the slopes were somewhat different. And then slide 70 shows the motor activity effects for these same four carbamates. Now, on slide 71, as I've already mentioned, there are several ways to statistically test these mixtures. This graph shows the relative potency factor mixture for brain cholinesterase. The red line shows the 95% confidence limits of the predicted response at each dose, and the black line shows the actual data. These data were included in the cumulative risk assessment, as you saw earlier in Anna's talk. It's pretty obvious that the actual data were really similar to and with contained within the 95% confidence limits of the expected data. Now, if you go to the next slide, slide 72, you can get, if you use parameters from the individual dose response curves, you can get the type of predicted line of additivity that I showed you with the OPs. And again, for this case of brain cholinesterase, the experimental data matched nicely with the additivity line, and it was an additive interaction. If you go to the next slide, you'll see the data for the relative potency factor mixture on motor activity. And likewise, the motor activity data were well predicted by the individual data. And again, this was additive. Slide 74 shows that things were kind of different for the California mixture. This graph shows the predicted line and the actual data. These data are currently being analyzed, and I don't have the experimental fitted model, but the statistical test shows that this is a non-additive response in the direction of synergy. If you go to the next slide, you'll see the same picture with motor activity. The actual data are shifted to the left of the predicted line, and this was a statistically significant shift. So to summarize our carbamate data, we've shown that a mixture based on relative potency of the component showed additivity, but the mixture based on usage in California showed synergy. And this clearly illustrates differences in outcomes that can be based on the mixing ratio of the components. On to slide 77. There are plenty of other studies that have incorporated this type of ray design for studying mixtures. I've listed a few of them here because they illustrate differences in some of the approaches to experimental design. The first study looked at four water disinfection byproducts and based the mixing ratio on the actual data from 35 water treatment plants. The next study looked at 18 polyhalogenated aromatic hydrocarbons. The ratio in this case was based on combining data from levels in human breast milk as well as food sources and the concentrations of the mixture that were tested were in the range of concentrations found in humans. In this case, the effects on T4 were additive at the low doses, but synergy appeared at the higher doses. Another study looking at synthetic estrogens used a relative potency factor approach for the mixture, but tested this mixture with and without natural phytoestrogens to see the influence of the natural products. The nature of the interaction depended on the concentration as well as the presence of the phytoestrogens. The slide 78 summarizes the considerations that I've tried to describe. First, for environmentally relevant mixtures research, you need to focus on the appropriate experimental design and statistical analyses for the hypothesis being tested. The design can address specific exposure scenarios, such as choosing to look at high use or persistent chemicals with a high potential for human exposure. The mixing ratios should reflect these potential exposures, such as site-specific combinations. And as I said before, using a fixed ratio array design provides an efficient and focused research approach. I'm on slide 79. I've described a quantitative component-based research project that takes advantage of the wealth of information on exposures, monitoring, and defined dose response data. We've been able to collect data on well-conceived mixtures and address the influence of age, and you can also look at other influences such as gender and exposure routes. In some cases, we are moving towards the PBPK or other biologically based models to describe these interactions, as Anna mentioned with the pyrethroids. This is the type of luxury that OPP has since the pesticides are data rich. If you go to the next slide, slide 80, there are many cases where we have a Volkswagen instead of a Cadillac for mixture assessments. A lot of the time we need approaches that are less data intensive than what I've described. But even so, the experimental considerations that I've described here still apply. If you have at least some knowledge of both exposures and toxicity, there are approaches to use such as the hazard quotient or hazard index, organ toxicity dose, or toxicity equivalence factors. Or if you only know the composition of the mixture, there are ways to study sufficiently similar mixtures. So some of the challenges we're left with are listed on slide 81. It's important to know target organ toxicity for at least some of the components of a mixture. We don't have individual dose response data. There are published approaches for analyzing the mixtures, but they're not as powerful as what I've described. In some cases, you may know only some of the components, and you may need to evaluate similar mixtures or study a defined fraction with or without an undefined fraction. Finally, you have to consider factors that influence both exposure and response, such as the chronicity and timing of exposure, aggregate exposures, and the dose response at low environmental concentrations versus higher doses. At NHERL, we're proposing to pursue these areas of research in our research plans, and I hope that we have good discussions about this at the meeting in Chicago. With that, I'll end this presentation, and thank you for your attention, and I think we might have time for a few questions.
Ginger, I didn't think it possible, but you took us through two major research efforts on cumulative risk and mixtures data, and very, very well. So thank you very, very much. Gene, how about if we start with some questions on the from folks who have been streaming this through the computers?
Okay, sounds good. I'm going to start with one of the first questions we received, which goes back to the first portion of today's seminar. So this question will be directed at Anna. This is coming in from Washington, D.C., and they ask regarding slide number 7, how do you identify the common mechanism group? What type and level of data do you use?
Hold on, let me find slide 7. How do we do that? Well, we do it very carefully. We follow the guidance. We follow the principles in the mode of action framework. We look at a number of things, including the pesticidal mode of action, because often the pesticidal mode of action of how it acts on an insect or a fungus or is the same way it happens in mammalian systems. We look at historical data, a lot of things.
Okay, great. Slide number 12. The question, this is also coming in from a different party in Washington, D.C. They ask you to recap once again how the BMD is determined.
Well, the BMD stands for benchmark dose, and a benchmark dose can be calculated one of many ways. EPA's and CEA really has the lead effort on the agency's benchmark dose software, and Jeff Gift is the person to talk to at that. In the case of our cumulative assessments, the carbamate and the OP assessment, we have actually not used the agency's BMDS software. Woody Setzer has calculated our benchmark doses for us using his own code developed in R, which is a software package that's freely available that a lot of high-power statisticians use.
This is Andrew. I just on a very, very general level, the benchmark dose is a statistical method of using all of the data across the dose response curve rather than depending on just a single point that might be a no observed adverse effect level or a lowest observed adverse effect level. So it's one of the ways that the agency has moved to try to use all of the data that are submitted and or made available rather than getting huge amounts of data and throwing it all away except for one or two critical points.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Same individual is also asking on slide number 33, what does MOE stand for?
MOE stands for margin of exposure. It's a type of a risk metric that we use a lot, but a lot of the other programs use a margin of exposure. It's a ratio, it's a margin of, bigger the MOE, the bigger the MOE, the safer it is. The smaller the MOE, the less safe it is. I have to flip the ratio. To calculate an MOE, you need a measure of hazard, so either on RFD or a benchmark dose or NOEL or something like that. You need a measure of exposure, so a residue of something, and you also need your line in the sand, whether it's the uncertainty factors you have or some other metric that your program uses that it gives you the line in the sand for your risk managers.
Okay, great. We have two more questions that came in online. The next one came in from Oklahoma, and they ask, what is the time frame for new pesticides to be studied before acceptable by regulators?
For a bioregulator, as in a pesticide that works with a bioregulator, I assume? I'm not the person to answer that, but if someone can get their name, I can refer them to the right folks. We have an entire division where I don't work of people who do new registrations, who work with the public and the pesticide manufacturers to register new products. But there's a very defined process for that. There's an act called the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act, otherwise known as PREA, that mandates how that works.
I'd like to move to questions for Dr. Moser. Is there anyone on the telephone line who has a question for Ginger Moser?
Hi, this is Linda Wilson from New York. I was wondering if anybody has considered how inerts play a role in these interactions.
Inerts are a definitely interesting question because, as you probably know, inerts are not necessarily inert, and a lot of times they are things like solvents and xylenes and things like that that have biological activities on their own. I think there is a move to start looking at that, and I think that there are ways where you could study that by looking at mixtures, for example, with and without inerts and seeing if the presence of the inerts change the interaction. Those kinds of experimental designs, of course, would have to be worked out individually, but it is an issue that probably needs more attention.
Anna, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit of the regulatory context. We have a major initiative that's ongoing currently to reassess all the inerts used in pesticide products. That effort has not at all looking at mixtures, but it's something that everyone is thinking a lot about. The way pesticide products are produced is a lot of inerts, quote unquote, are included in the mixture to do a particular thing. They're used to help the pesticide get into the plant or help to stick to the plant or help to help the pesticide. So they do things. They do things like eat away the outside of the leaf, or they help things be sticky. And so there's a lot of people thinking about that if those things do that for pests, that it's possible that they do that in human situations, and that you could have pharmacokinetics in more availability through absorption from some of these inerts than people have thought about before. So it's something people are more and more thinking a lot about. But there's a big challenge with inerts is that they can be changed around quite a bit. So it's hard to track what's in what. It's an issue.
Anna, would you say that the inerts, possibly even more than the active pesticide products, are part of what are driving some of the tox testing and the attempts to add innovation to tox testing, since probably the number of inerts dwarfs the numbers of active pesticide compounds out there?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right on. And our vision of the testing of the 21st century really begins with screening and thinking about inerts and doing high throughput testing on inerts for purposes of screening is a major consideration up here.
Thank you very much. Another question on the telephone. Yeah. Any more online?
Yeah, we have one more question online in regards to slide number 24. And they say on slide 24, it excludes the prenatal exposure. Is exposure to this population being addressed?
This is Anna again. Yes, the prenatal exposure is being included. We do, not on here, that should be on here, that's a missing piece. We do explicitly do all women of childbearing age as a separate group. I'm surprised that's not on the slide. I'll just tell David. We do women of childbearing age as their own group. And prenatal exposure and how we do that in our assessments comes in many ways in how we put the hazard assessment together. If you have a situation where a pregnant woman is more sensitive or her fetus is more sensitive, that would drive the selection of what hazard assessment. So our assessments in general are driven by the most sensitive group, whether it's young children or whether it's pregnant women. So we definitely definitely consider them in a very explicit way.
Okay, great. That seems to be the end of the online questions.
Terrific. And it's 12:29 Central Time. It's 1:29 Eastern Time. And I want to thank our speakers very, very much, Ginger and Anna. Terrific job taking us through a very, very complex and data-rich area. For those of you who are from the Environmental Protection Agency, I'll remind you once again that this workshop on cumulative risk assessment, 2 weeks from now, July 28th through 30th in Chicago in the Region 5 conference facility. Registration is still open, and please do, if you're planning on coming, please do go to that website and register so that you can get a place at the workshop and also reserve some hotel space. In fact, I think we're working with the hotel, but their first deadline was today for holding our block of rooms. So thank you all very, very much, and we'll be seeing you in Chicago.
This is Jean. Just before you sign everyone off on the phone lines, if you can hop onto the very last slide number 83, there are two important links, one to additional resources relevant to today's seminar, as well as a feedback form. Those of you who are looking for confirmation for your participation today or would like to take a minute or two to let us know what you thought of this particular seminar as well as the series, we'd greatly appreciate if you could take a moment to fill that out, because I do personally read all of those feedback forms, and we use that to try to improve our future deliveries.
Thank you very, very much, Jean. All right, so long, everyone.